Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and help provide solutions that suit how you do business. From liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
Top Thrill 2 is like no other course. Two 420-foot vertical speedways, three launches.
All right, let's talk strategy.
Copy that, driver. Go for maximum acceleration off the start.
Measure that.
You've got a short straightaway to push from 0 to 74 on the first vertical speedway.
And what about the rollback?
Rollback will set you up for an explosive reverse climb 420 feet in the sky so you reach 0 G's in total weightlessness.
420 feet of straight-up speed. Let's get it.
Top Thrill 2, the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch strata coaster. Get your tickets at cedarpoint.com.
This is Bloomberg Business Week. Insight from the reporters and editors who bring you America's most trusted business magazine.
Plus, global business, finance, and tech news.
The Bloomberg Business Week podcast with Carol Messer and Tim Stenebeck from Bloomberg Radio.
When we're talking about China being the world's second largest economy, and also when you're looking at Bloomberg Economics, really thinking that when you're looking at the trajectory of its growth, not quite holding up as much as obviously economists were anticipating. And then also when you're thinking about, Tim, the liquidity crunch it's going under, when you're thinking about some of those property developers and the pressure that they have been under so significantly, what this could really mean when you're looking at global economic growth. And then obviously the U.S. economy, which has proven to be pretty resilient here.
Yeah, just doing a great job of laying out all the challenges when we do look at China, the world's second largest economy. To get an idea where China's economy is headed and its effect on global growth, we're very pleased to have with us this afternoon Leland Miller, CEO at China Beige Book International. Leland joining us on Zoom from Washington, D.C. Leland, how are you?
Doing well, thank you.
Well, thanks so much for joining us. You might have heard us mention earlier this morning that we actually saw Bloomberg Economics cut its long-term forecast as the post-COVID rebound has run out of steam. This for China. It's pretty remarkable to see this. And just a couple weeks ago, Carol and I were talking to some folks who said, you know what? It's no longer a growth story the same way that it has been in China for years. And in fact, we could see higher growth here in the U.S. That's just not something we talked about a few years ago. Where do you fall, Leland?
Well, it was something we were talking about for the past 10 years, but, you know, nobody really wanted to hear about it because, you know, the idea was China was growing at 8% or they were growing at close to 8%. And most people didn't really see a reason why the economic magic couldn't continue. The growth model had worked up to that point. Why couldn't they still crank out another 20 years at 8%? So I think that was the mindset up until relatively recently when people realized that, look, no one in Beijing is an economic magician any more than anywhere else in the world. You know, they're subject to the laws of economics. And when they have the system that they have, it has structurally pumped up growth for a while, but there's going to be a much more precipitous slowdown on the way down. So I think, first of all, we have to be ready for a future of significant slowdown going forward, a structural slowdown. And second, when you're looking at whether the United States can pass whether China can pass the United States or whether it doesn't or not, I think that the issue here is that if Xi Jinping falls victim to the mindset that he has to pass the United States and they do everything that's needed in order to pass the United States in GDP growth, then China will be going the wrong direction. I think they'll, you know, Xi Jinping will be reversing some of the stuff he's been doing for the past several years. It's caused a lot of, you know, pressure on the economy, but has been towards the idea of getting debt under control. So to the extent that China passes the United States, which looks unlikely, it's always looked unlikely, but if it does happen, it means Xi Jinping is doing the wrong things, not the right things.
Why is it that the post-COVID rebound just didn't hold?
That's a great question. I mean, you know, we were very cautious, particularly early in the year, saying, look, there's a lot that China has to get over. You have to break down the COVID zero administrative state. You know, businesses have been frozen in place for a year now. But even we were surprised at how tepid the recovery was in the second quarter. I think it all comes down to confidence. When you look at what's happening in the economy, firms didn't like what they were coming out of. They didn't know what was happening. And so there wasn't a sense of confidence in the economy. If you don't have confidence, then you're not borrowing, you're not hiring, you're not spending. There was some of this, But not enough of it. And so you had a sequential recovery in month to month to month throughout 2023, but it was nowhere near what people were expecting or hoping for. And so people have become very, very despondent on what they're seeing in the economy right now.
So Leland, what does this all mean for American investors and American companies that do business or want to do business in China?
Well, I think this is, you know, piece by piece, we have been opening the eyes of foreign investors. I mean, you know, a long time ago, it was first geopolitics, and then it was the trade war, and then it was, you know, COVID, and then it was COVID zero. And now it's, you know, low growth after COVID zero and with the foreign crackdown on foreign businesses. So there hasn't been one thing that convinced foreign investors, foreign businesses that they had to be more careful about going into China. Maybe they didn't want to go there. Maybe they had to pull their supply chains out. It's been incremental. But I think when we got to COVID zero, finally, I think a lot of foreign businesses, they just said enough is enough. We can't operate here. It's not worth it. And, you know, we can't be susceptible to having our supply chains severed because somebody decides to do a nationwide lockdown.
But if you're Nike, if you're Disney, you're not going to throw in the towel. If you're Apple, yeah, sure, you're going to move your supply chains a little bit. I mean, but that company is just so intertwined with China.
That's exactly right. So what you're going to do is you're going to bifurcate your operations. So you're going to have a China operations, you're going to have an ex-China operations. That allows you not to have supply chains that are tangled up. You produce in China for Chinese consumers. If you think that's a great market, then you stay in there and you ramp it up. But you know, if you're mostly ramping up for foreign consumers, maybe you don't run your supply chains through China anymore. So yes, absolutely. There's companies that don't want to have, that absolutely don't want to pull themselves out of China and won't. But I think they're changing their approach in how they treat the China part of the equation.
How concerned are you about China's property debt crisis?
I'll be real provocative here, and I'll say I'm not concerned at all. Not that things aren't a mess. We spent all of August, you know, everyone's supposed to be on vacation. We spent all of August listening to people say that China's collapsing, the imminent hard landing. We had a lot of people worried about that, had a lot of, you know, notes going out saying, look, China's not collapsing. Here's what's actually happening. It's not that the property sector isn't a mess. The property sector is a mess. You've got a big shadow bank that's wobbling right now in Country Garden, which you had 2 years ago in Evergrande. It freaked everybody out. A lot of problems with the property sector. But China is not a typical economic system. It is a non-commercial financial system, which means they're much less susceptible to things like a Lehman moment, like an acute crisis. So you have the ability to do things in a non-commercial financial system that you can't do in the West, you can't do in the US, can't do in Europe. And so the idea that this is going to create some sort of sense of financial contagion and just roll everybody over, very, very unlikely. But it does cause stresses to the system. And I think that it's happening right now because the Chinese government is allowing it to happen. When it starts looking like it's going to go out of control, then they step in and they ease conditions a bit.
What are they going to do in terms of stepping in? I mean, are you talking a question of moral hazard here? Like they're not going to let anything fail?
Well, I think they know that they are creating very, very difficult conditions inside the property sector. What they want to keep the problems inside of property. So you want to make sure that financial contagion isn't spreading to other areas of the economy. You want to make sure that cash flow doesn't completely freeze up. And so that's why you're seeing easing measures right now. So, I mean, we have a fiscal activity index we track, a monetary stimulus index we track, and we could see that as they are pushing harder on some of these issues, like, you know, the resolution on these shadow banks and as property continues to deteriorate, then they step in and they give it a little bit of juice on the side. And so there is a push and pull on these things. But in terms of a bank, a big shadow bank falling in it, causing the system to fall apart in a domino effect like we saw with Lehman, that's not going to happen in China.
So what other corners within the economy have been able to offset those concerns when you're talking about, when you're looking at what's happening with the property debt crisis not being as big of an issue as maybe people are thinking at this point?
Well, one of the problems is you haven't had real strength anywhere else to compensate. So if the conversation right now is, you know, are things going great or are they going not that great, then it's a difficult thing to hash out. But, you know, luckily for us, it's been very easy because the question is China growing or is China collapsing? And China's clearly not collapsing. I think the whole thing is ludicrous that is the sentiment people have right now. If you look at what's happening in the manufacturing sector, it's actually held up much more impressively this year than we thought it would. You've got enormous headwinds. You're coming off 3 years of gangbusters growth. It's manufacturing's holding its own. Is it doing great? Is it doing 2022 low? It's not what it was, but it's doing okay. It's not a huge weak point. The consumption parts of the economy, we look at retail and services, are they doing great? Well, parts of services are, but overall, doing okay, you know, very uneven. So they're not a real bright spot. It's just, you know, you're not seeing great stuff out of China. You're not seeing good data, but you're just not seeing anywhere near as negative a story as a lot of people think is happening inside the walls of the economy.
Well, hey, just before we let you go, Leland, talk about political implications here. She is president for life, as you said in the past. Any political implications in 30 seconds?
This is Xi's show. So we can, you know, we spent a lot of time talking about how, you know, foreign investors say, oh, Xi Jinping would never do this because ... I think after a year of COVID zero, we should be coming to the conclusion that there is nothing Xi Jinping won't do simply because we don't think he'll do it. Mm-hmm. He'll be very humble in evaluating where he's taking the economy. And it's in a very different direction than he ran in the past.
All right, we're going to have to leave it there. Thank you so much for taking the time this afternoon. That's Leland Miller, CEO at China Beige Book International, joining us this afternoon on Zoom from Washington, D.C.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Business Week podcast. Catch us live weekday afternoons from 3 to 6 Eastern. Listen on Bloomberg.com, the iHeartRadio app, and the Bloomberg Business app. Or watch us live on YouTube.
Tim, we all know how much AI is all the hype.
Look no further than NVIDIA's year-to-date increase of 200% or more.
Exactly. Though questions do remain about what this all means for cybersecurity, particularly in the workplace, especially since generative AI applications continue to evolve. So we have Dana Simberkoff, Chief Risk, Privacy, and Information Security Officer at AvePoint, joining us on Zoom from New Hampshire to explain why the cybersecurity industry isn't ready for the AI boom and what guardrails companies should use to protect their employees. Dana, thanks so much for joining us. As always, I want to get your thoughts on that, because when we are discussing, like Tim and myself, about this AI boom, why is it that cybersecurity companies may not be ready for this just yet?
Well, thanks, Jess and Tim, for having me this afternoon. Great to be with you. I think AI is just yet another obstacle in the road to looking for that perfect security solution that just doesn't exist out there, honestly. So artificial intelligence and sort of the deep learning that is coming through technologies like ChatGPT really puts cyber professionals on edge, because this is just one more ripple in the world we live in, where cyber professionals have to be right 100% of the time, and bad guys only have to be right once in order to get inside of your defenses.
So, and there's no shortage of bad guys out there, Dana, as we certainly know. So what's the worst case scenario here? I mean, describe for us what kind of keeps you up at night. What makes you scared?
Well, I think that really the secret to building a good program and addressing this is really to go back to cyber hygiene basics, doing what we do every day, which is making sure that we have good data governance in place within our companies and across our partner ecosystems. Because if you know what information you're handling, if you know what it is, where it is, who can access it, and how it's being shared, then you can largely mitigate some of the risks that are associated with AI. So at the end of the day, it does... Oh, I'm sorry.
Oh, no, continue.
No, I was just going to say, at the end of the day, it does come down to people, policy, and technology. So there really is no bad technology, just bad use of technology.
And when you're talking about cybersecurity, are there particular sub-industries or companies that you think might potentially be more vulnerable than others?
Well, I certainly think that the ability for, again, those malicious bad actors to use AI to potentially perpetrate cybercrime, take advantage of insiders inside of a company, to really accelerate the process of cyber attacks we've already seen through phishing and smishing, where somebody receives a phone call or a text message saying that they are an executive that need help right away. Just imagine that amplified with the ability to actually, you know, fake person over video, these deep fakes that we've been hearing about, where the person's image or voice could be easily replicated.
Well, Dana, you said phishing. We all know about phishing. Did you say smishing?
Smishing, yes. Smishing is using using a text message.
Oh.
Or some kind of social media, so whether it's WhatsApp or your phone or just pretending to be somebody that you're not and using technology to get to an intended target. And this is really common. We see it a lot, both inside of our company as we build our own cyber defenses, but also across our customer ecosystem, where it really isn't just what you know, but who you are that makes you a target potentially within a company.
Yeah, I didn't know that. That's what it was called. We had a great cover story, an excerpt from Zeke Fox's forthcoming book, Number Go Up, that talked all about where those text messages actually come from. So I encourage everybody listening who's interested to go check that one out. It was just a couple of weeks ago. Okay, so Dana, what about when it comes to, when I think about the worst case scenario, I understand, I consider myself pretty savvy when it comes to not answering those phishing emails. And we certainly get trained pretty well here at Bloomberg. And I think a lot of companies do that in this day and age.
They send us some trick emails at times just to see if we get caught.
Yeah, they do. You gotta be vigilant. I think my concern though is how generative AI sort of changes that. And it makes it so it's really not possible to distinguish what is real and what isn't real. So let's say that the weakest link is always the person. Where do companies like AvePoint come in to try to stop that from happening?
Well, I think at the end of the day, it really is going to come down to not only identity, but also technology and what we allow individuals to do. So just in the same way we've been talking over the last really couple of years with COVID about now the borderless office, where employees are working really from anywhere in the world, their home, Starbucks, the office. That means that there's no perimeter around the office that you can protect. And so identity really has become that new perimeter to a great extent. And making sure that you know who you're talking to and who you are is going to be critical. And limiting the ability for somebody to move either horizontally or vertically within a company if they are impersonated is going to really help sort of fill that gap and protect against that kind of risk.
We actually did hear from Zscaler after the bell. They did report earnings and their forecast for EPS did beat estimates. But of course, when it comes to a cloud cybersecurity company like this, and I have to note it stocks up more than 5% in after hours trading, how does cloud play into this? And when it comes to AI as well and some of your concerns?
Well, cloud is both an opportunity and a risk, but certainly AvePoint as a cloud-first company providing services to millions of our customers around the world takes advantage of a lot of the built-in security controls that exist through our partners like Microsoft and others. There's also real opportunity with AI in the cloud to benefit from the kind of machine learning and intelligence that could also be used to fight cybercrime. So I think there are tremendous opportunities that the cloud brings, but really at the end of the day, it's somebody else's computer. And so that good data hygiene, data governance is going to be critical to making sure that whether you're in the cloud or on-premise, that you're really doing the right things to protect your business and your data.
Is there a future for on-premise or is it all in the cloud?
Well, hard to say. I think, the cloud is certainly the future. It's the wave. It's the direction that we see companies moving more and more. I think that there will likely always be some hybrid environments. And depending on your industry, depending on the kind of information you have, cloud is not always possible, but we'll see. Yeah, we never say never, and I think it's always good to hedge your bets.
Whenever you speak to companies, what is their biggest concern right now?
Well, again, I think it is knowing where that data is. It's that unknown, that risk of not knowing is never better. And so, the challenge for AI is clearly that you can have a machine outpacing you rapidly. We now see that our computers regularly are asking us to prove that we're human by answering things like CAPTCHAs when you go to websites. Will computers outpace humans at some point? Maybe. I think, again, for cybersecurity and privacy professionals, it's building accountability into the way that we use data, making sure that there's good transparency with our customers, and making sure that we're really, doing the right thing to maximize the opportunity for businesses to do what they should be doing while protecting the rights of individuals and data subjects.
I don't know, Jess, do you ever have a problem with those CAPTCHAs? I feel like the CAPTCHAs have already outsmarted me. I mean, you know what I'm talking about, right? Those things, those little tests.
They can be tough.
Yeah. I mean, come on.
I mean, I mean, I honestly, like, one time I got one of those Bloomberg emails and I accidentally clicked on something, then I had to go back through and do all of the training. Oh, so yeah. I'm super vigilant now and not doing
You're busted.
That.
You only make that mistake once.
I know, exactly. So never again after doing that.
Well, that's good. That's good fiber training.
It really is.
Yeah, we have some pretty, you know, and it takes a while to do those trainings too.
So exactly.
You can't
so you'll
save
never
it
forget.
For the last day, Dana. I'll tell you that. Dana Simberkoff, really appreciate you taking the time. She's Chief Risk, Privacy, and Information Security Officer at AvePoint, joining us on Zoom from New Hampshire this afternoon. I think there's a lot of questions about what the future of sort of the hybrid cloud is, Jess, and
yes.
You know, whether or not what's on premise and what's not on premise, especially with the multinational companies where those servers are based. You see that certainly with, you know, tech companies that
right.
are, you know, required to co-locate servers in certain countries, and then those servers and that information is under the jurisdiction of that area. So it gets really complicated.
Johann Schmiegel, you've got the world's highest IQ.
Yes, 247.
Wow. Did you know that thanks to Salesforce with Einstein AI, everyone's smarter? Now everyone's an Einstein, just like you.
But I'm the smartest.
Not anymore. With connected data and trusted AI, everyone can give customers experiences they've only dreamed of. Oh, look, here's a few Einsteins now.
Hey, hi.
Hola, amigo.
Everyone's an Einstein?
It's okay, Johann. Let it happen. The number one AI CRM. Now everyone's an Einstein with Salesforce.
Rev up your thrills this summer at Cedar Point on the all-new Top Thrill 2. Drive the sky on the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch vertical speedway. And now, for a limited time, get more Cedar Point fun for less with our limited-time bundle for just $49.99. Get admission, parking, and all-day drinks for one low price. But you better hurry, because this bundle won't last long. Save now at cedarpoint.com.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Business Week podcast. Catch us live weekday afternoons from 3 to 6 Eastern on Bloomberg Radio, the Bloomberg Business app, and YouTube. You can also listen live on Amazon Alexa from our flagship New York station. Just say, Alexa, play Bloomberg 1130.
Tim, as you know, we discussed earlier in today's Big Take with Bloomberg's Matt Boyle, workers in Asia and Europe have largely returned to offices at a faster pace than their American counterparts more than 3 years after COVID shifted corporate life. Now, U.S. employers are demanding a workplace reset, and they want it now on everything from action on societal issues and work-life boundaries, per Edelman's latest Trust Barometer report. So who better to walk us through this latest report? Back with us again is Richard Edelman's Chief Executive Officer at the firm, who is joining us on Zoom in New York City to discuss these latest findings. Thanks so much, Richard, for chatting with us again. Walk us through what you think are the biggest takeaways from these latest figures that you have.
I think the first important finding is that my employer is substantially trusted more than any other institution. So trust is local in my CEO and in my company's ability to make change. 25 points higher than the other institution, 60 points higher than government in terms of ethics. The second big finding is the trust gap for so-called deskless workers. In other words, people who are either on the factory floor or operating as sort of independent contractors, they have substantially less trust in institutions. The third big finding, which you led the broadcast with, is workers want a reset. Two-thirds of people say, I want to change my work-life balance. This is a 3 years after COVID kind of reaction, saying, you know, I'm not so fast, folks.
Are they, Richard, still in control, though? I mean, yes, we're still adding over 100,000 jobs each month here in the United States, but We're not hearing from executives to the same extent that we were in the last couple of years, how much trouble they're having finding employees. Who's in the driver's seat?
So employees think that they are, because they're saying by 6 to 1, 7 to 1, I want my CEO to speak up on societal issues. I expect that, in fact, you're going to listen to me when I want to make change. I expect, in a sense, sort of a partnership as opposed to a classic employer-employee relationship. But this is being sorted out because the employer has the tightrope also of don't get into politics. And, you know, be careful on especially in the U.S., on steering clear of, you know, electoral politics or, you know, things that will get you into trouble.
When you're talking about work-life boundaries, what specifically are employees looking for?
Employees are looking for, in a sense, a new compact that says, you'll listen to me, you'll come visit me on the factory floor and get my input. In fact, the deskless worker who actually feels very disconnected is connected if the company trusts them. So that matter of going out and listening, but also we want to hear in the halls of power the voice of our CEO expressing our views.
Does this change based on the type of industry that the company's in? Like, you know, if you're working for one company in one sector versus a company in another sector, is it different?
I think in tech and financial services, it's sort of the counter positions where financial companies are really ordering employees back. The CEOs of tech companies, because they have, you know, talents and are remote programmers, theoretically can work solo.
But sorry, but Richard, what I mean in terms of trust.
Company, but what we found in our own company, trust is made up of four things: ability, dependability, integrity, and purpose.
Okay.
And the ability to come together in the office, I think, gives some sense of culture and also some sense of shared purpose. So, you know, we're encouraging a hybrid structure, and several of our clients are following suit.
Tim and I have been discussing a lot this afternoon with this theme about, especially when we're talking about the U.S. and employers trying to get their employees back into the office. What do you think is the catalyst that changed that? Is that a potential? Because we don't see a recession on the horizon, but at a particular point in the business cycle, if you do see that shift with a slowing economy and then job cuts are coming, is that the shift that employers think could potentially shift the power there?
The power struggle is a standoff, and the smart company will find a way between and move gradually if that's the direction. But what employees really want is to feel as if they're getting value from their employer, that the employer's listening, that it's not going to go back to the pre-2020 method of talk down to me. I want to be represented. I want to be heard. I want to feel as if I'm making change. By 8-1, people say, I'm prepared to come to work for a company if that company stands up on human rights or on sustainability or on race and diversity. So that matters.
So when it comes to thinking about what the takeaways are for leaders who are listening to our program, who are watching our program right now, what have you learned in the years that you've been doing the Trust Barometer and how it's changed? Because I got to tell you, last couple of times we've had you on, it's been similar findings, Richard, that the company is the one where people trust as an institution more than government. So what's the big takeaway for executives listening?
My employer is so much more trusted than any other institution. There are huge expectations of you in satisfying what an employee wants from a societal point of view, work-life balance. It's complicated by the reality of politics in today's world. So I would identify the three or four key issues on which I'm going to speak, which have to do with your own values and your core competencies. And they're probably in the area of sustainability, diversity and inclusion, geopolitics when it matters, like getting out of Russia, and lastly, wages and reskilling. On the other issues, talk with your employees, talk internally, but be careful about what you say in a public sense as an advocate, because again, you'll get right into the R versus D, and the differences could not be more stark.
Yeah, that's certainly an area where, you don't want to bring that up when you're with new people you meet or in the workplace, right? Religion and politics, those are
right,
things.
Right, polarizing to topics.
Richard Edelman, we love it when you join us. CEO of Edelman joining us on Zoom from New York City. Some really interesting findings in this. And, we had Richard join us. We have him join us several times a year. Often he joins us from Davos, where he is the World Economic Forum. And talking to these leaders, Jess, who are making these decisions about the ways that they run their business.
Johann Schmiegel, you've got the world's highest IQ.
Yes, 247.
Wow, did you know that thanks to Salesforce with Einstein AI, everyone's smarter? Now everyone's an Einstein, just like you.
But I'm the smartest.
Not anymore. With connected data and trusted AI, everyone can give customers experiences they've only dreamed of. Oh, look, here's a few Einsteins now.
Hey, hi.
Hola, amigo.
Everyone's an Einstein?
It's okay, Johann, let it happen. The number one AI CRM. Now everyone's an Einstein with Salesforce.
Rev up your thrills this summer at Cedar Point on the all-new Top Thrill 2.
Drive the sky on the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch vertical speedway. And now, for a limited time, get more Cedar Point fun for less with our limited-time bundle for just $49.99. Get admission, parking, and all-day drinks for one low price. But you better hurry, because this bundle won't last long. Save now at cedarpoint.com.
I'm driving in my car. I turn on the radio.
Yeah, how about you let me drive?
Oh, no.
Who's gonna drive you home?
Honey, please, I'll do the driving.
Drive on.
Excuse me, I wanna drive.
Keep drive, stay in prison.
It's the question that drives us.
This is the Drive to the Close.
That funky music will drive us till the dawn.
On Bloomberg Radio.
Well, it is that time. Time for us to drive to the close. We are just shy of 18 minutes until the U.S. markets close here in New York. Very pleased to have back with us this afternoon Abhay Deshpande, founder and chief investment officer at Centerstone Investors. Abhay joining us on Zoom from New York City. Abhay, how are you?
I'm doing well. Unfortunately, summer's over, but...
Is it, though? It's still so hot, and it doesn't seem like everyone's back to work. Does it? Is summer over?
I don't know. It's COVID era, right?
Yeah, exactly. We've talked a lot about that this afternoon. Hey, we love talking to you because you always come with some great picks. We're going to get to those in just a minute. But first, I want to start with macro because you're kind of in a different camp. You're not really talking about a soft landing. You argue that a mild recession could be coming.
Yeah, I mean, they're functionally similar, though. I mean, I'm not looking for like a huge 2008 or 9 or even 2020-ish decline in economic activity. But I mean, it's hard to argue that with the kinds of interest rate changes that we've had and the wild sort of spending spree that we were on, that there shouldn't be a period of retrenchment. I think there definitely will be. Seems to be already started, have already started. But whether that, you know, evolves into something you know, that's the end of the world. I just don't believe it. But I guess, as a famous person once said, the future is uncertain. So
what would be the catalyst to have growth slow down? I'm looking at the ECFC function and the terminal that obviously looks at the aggregate for economists, and they don't have a quarter over quarter contraction anymore for the remaining quarters this year.
So this is one of the issues, is that when we talk about the economy, we're talking about in the United States, a $20 trillion behemoth. Economies are adaptable. They're dynamic organisms, right? So it's very rare for the entire economy to just implode. It's just too big. There are too many pieces and too many slices. So I think the nuance is parts of the economy can slow down enough to give the impression of from a macro standpoint, a slowdown that would qualify as a recession. That would be like a 0%, kind of growth rate. Where I have trouble, like most people, seeing a major problem is employment. Will that really turn it? With all the shortages and labor shortages we have, it's hard to see like a huge, labor problem. And then at the same time, you have a lot of stimulus, and a lot of that, $500 billion really hasn't even gone through the system yet. Wow. From the IRA. So, there's plenty of stimulus. There's, at least fiscal stimulus. The monetary stimulus has obviously been tightened, but anecdotally, many, many, if not most households refinanced at very low rates just a couple of years ago. I mean, there's not as much of a direct impact. Like if this was a 4 or 5 year economic cycle, I think interest rates would have much more of a kind of impact. But households are termed out. Where you can see the slowdown occurring is it's in the lower end, and we see this in the results from companies like Dollar General, which we recently began to purchase, where that consumer is hurting from the interest rate increases. But it's a smaller segment. It's a lot of people, obviously, but it's a smaller segment for the as a proportion of the total spend in the economy. But you can definitely see that there's slowdown here and there. And most people probably don't believe that there's going to be a direct hit to the entire economy. Those types of where the economy, quote unquote, like uniformly succumbs to weakness, that tends to be led by a financial issue, like a banking crisis like we had 15 years ago. I don't see
what about a regional banking crisis?
I mean, had an issue for a brief moment of time in that region. But I was just talking to some mortgage brokers the other day, and the banks are lending. The banks are lending freely, even to the distressed homeowners for, you know, doing home equity buyout lines of credit, for instance, to pay off higher interest car loans. I mean, people are getting by somehow.
Okay, Abe, I want to talk about some of the picks that you brought with you. I want to start with a company that I don't get to talk about much, but I'm a cyclist, and I saw Shimano on your list. And some people might know it as a fishing tackle company, some as a bicycle component manufacturer. Why is Shimano one of your picks?
You know, so a lot of companies went through COVID and had a huge, you know, biking became very popular during COVID because of an outdoor activity. And so they had a big spike in demand. And now you're seeing the other side of that. You know, a lot of businesses have too much inventory. Retailers have a lot of inventory, a lot of different things, especially bikes. So there is a, you know, this issue kind of cycling through, quote unquote, the industry. And Shimano is not immune to that. Now, that said, Shimano is one of really two brands in their space. They kind of more or less dominate the bike parts business. These are derailleurs, brake parts, and things that you see in a bicycle. And typically, people spec the bike with the parts. The parts are actually more important than the bike in a lot of cases. So it's a branded good. It's a franchise. And where there's been technological development, like electronic shifting and whatnot, you know, Shimano's led that. So to me, it has all the hallmarks of a franchise. And in addition, which is somewhat still unusual for Japanese businesses, they're very shareholder oriented. They buy back stock, they pay a dividend. They understand what intrinsic value is for their own business. And as a consequence, we have a great deal of faith in management to be able to manage through this type of cycle. And since it's a franchise, we're more than willing to give them time.
We have about a minute left, but Ryanair and Porsche also on your list. What do you like about them?
Well, Ryanair, these are both, I'll take Ryanair first. You know, Ryanair, like Shimano, is a brand. Now, unlike Shimano, Ryanair has developed their brand by being the lowest cost provider in basically commodity industry, which is airlines. And they've done that by locking in gates and routes to airports that are offset out, you know, they're outside the city center. And they've done that and have been able to provide the lowest cost airline ticket for European travelers. That's a business that, because of the cost advantages that they have, seems to gain market share every time there's a weakness. And then when things rebound, they have emerged with greater number of gates and their routes expand as a result. So they just continue to gain market share. As much as you can be a franchise in the airline industry, they've got it. And it's very unlikely that anyone can displace them. So that's, you know, the primary reasons. And again, good management, good business model, and the balance sheet's very solid too. They own all the airplanes too, which gives me some comfort. They're not sitting there leasing.
Abe, we love it when you join us. That's Abe Deshpande joining us from Centerstone Investors. He's the founder and CIO at the company, joining us on Zoom from New York City.
This is the Bloomberg Business Week podcast, available on Apple, Spotify, and anywhere else you get your podcasts. Listen live weekday afternoons from 3 to 6 Eastern on Bloomberg.com, the iHeartRadio app, TuneIn, and the Bloomberg Business app. You can also watch us live every weekday on YouTube and always on the Bloomberg Terminal.
Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and help provide solutions that suit how you do business, from liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
Rev up your thrills this summer at Cedar Point on the all-new Top Thrill 2. Drive the sky on the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch vertical speedway. And now, for a limited time, get more Cedar Point fun for less with our limited-time bundle for just $49.99. Get admission, parking, and all-day drinks for one low price. But you better hurry, because this bundle won't last long. Save now at cedarpoint.com.